From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we usually have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area, but today is a milestone for us. We are celebrating our first birthday. To help with these celebrations, I have with me my regular co-host, Joelle Mitchell, and another regular from our team, Dr. Alicia Pappas. First of all, how are you today, Joelle?
Jason, I'm along with it being the first birthday of our podcast, it's also a year since I joined People Diagnostics.
Yeah, well, when this show airs, when it will be your 1 year anniversary on the 1st of February.
Yes. So do I say it's only been a year or it's been a year already? I'm not sure which one, because it sort of feels like both.
And now I feel like maybe I should have bought you something or done something special for your 1 year anniversary.
Well, you've still got time because this is, you know, it's pre-recorded, right? We're not there yet.
We're not there yet. So let me think about that. I'll see if you've deserved anything.
Really? You'll see?
We should probably have a performance review. That would be a good thing to do on your anniversary.
That'd be swell. Yeah. Maybe I could give you a performance review as well.
You do it every day. Cool. So 1 year. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, but everything well with you?
Yes. For possibly the first time in this entire podcast, there is nothing catastrophic going on in my life.
Yeah, and in fact, I walked past your car this morning and it was glistening.
Shiny. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I finally got the scratch fixed. So the smash repairers all did all the detailing and everything. So it looks nice for a change.
So maybe year two, we're going to hear about how great your life is.
Don't jinx it.
Okay.
It's shush.
It's starting well. just saying. All right. Well, let's hope it continues in that vein and I hopefully haven't jinxed it. But we've also got with us Dr. Alicia Pappas, all the way from Melbourne. How are you, Alicia?
I'm not too bad, Jason and Joelle. Hello, team in Perth. I'm recovering from COVID because, as you know, Melbourne and Sydney are the COVID capitals in Australia and you've been spared so far. So if anyone's listening and you're hearing me sniffle or cough, I apologise, but I will try and utilise my mute button to avoid any symptoms appearing while we're recording.
Yes, our Emperor Mark McGowan has kept us safe valiantly over the last couple of years and has continued to keep us safe by deciding to shut our borders or keep them shut, controversially.
Indeed, yes. There's opinions are split on that. Yes.
Yes. But look, glad to hear that it was a mild dose that you got and that you are definitely on the mend, Alicia.
Yes. And just for listeners out there, Alicia is actually recovered. We're not making her do this podcast while she's actively sick with COVID.
No.
Yes. Good disclaimer there, Joelle. I have been fine pretty much for a week. I just have some residual symptoms like a lot of people, but yes, got the mild version. So all good over here.
Yeah, terrific. Well, today, as I said, is our first, I'm saying first anniversary. Joelle would prefer to call it birthday.
Yeah, it's been a year.
It's been a year since we first published and I've got some statistics for our first year. So in our first year, we've had 74 episodes. Now, this is episode 80. But that's because we had 6 replay episodes over Christmas. In that time, we've had 63 guests on the podcast from all over the world. We've had 6 live panels, 27,000 downloads to date, which is just amazing, really.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So I think Joelle wanted to celebrate
20,000.
We did celebrate 10,000.
Yeah. And you said we couldn't celebrate till 25 and then you were conveniently away for 25.
I was on holidays during that. Yeah. So, but look, we're celebrating our first birthday.
Yes.
So we'll celebrate the 27,000 downloads at that time.
Why not?
Yeah. Alicia, any guess on what our most downloaded episode was of the year?
I would have to say it was likely Professor Tony LaMontagne from Deakin University.
Close. Tony was number 2. Yeah.
Was he number two, was he? I'm a bit biased because I did used to work with Tony, so.
Yes, and, you know, Tony, I think Joel and I have unabashedly said that that was our favourite episode of the year. He was absolutely amazing, and it was definitely worth the wait to get him on episode 55.
Yep, and worth the 90-minute listen as well.
Yeah, so it was our longest until Don Bakuri
until
came,
Don, yeah.
which was our last episode of the year, just beat it. But no, believe it or not, episode number one was the most downloaded episode with Joelle and myself.
Mm. So does that mean that there was a bunch of people who listened to episode one and were like, nope, not listening to any more of this?
I've had a taste.
Deleting this from my playlist.
Unsubscribe. Yes. very possibly. We don't know how much of that episode was listened to.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. And we didn't know each other either. So it was a bit awkward.
Yeah.
And plus, you didn't know plus you were gonna I was, video. Yeah, like. Jason just sprung all these cameras on me and lights and stuff. I was just came in thinking it was just going to be audio. And then suddenly it was like I was in a film studio and it was, I actually thought he was testing me.
Yeah. I'm a psychologist after all.
Well, that's why I'm like, really? What is happening here? Is he actually clueless or is this some kind of a mean test?
No, I've learned since to let people know because, Joelle had to go, oh, can I just go to the bathroom quickly and put on some makeup.
I don't carry makeup with me.
Okay, well, you had to put on something. I don't. I'm a man. I don't.
I typically may have just needed the bathroom for general bathroom reasons.
No, this is the story that you told me. You had to go put on some lippy or
no,
something.
No, this was when I was before I got there. I was getting ready and thinking, do I need to put makeup on or not? Yeah. Because it's just going to be audio.
Yeah.
That was where that came from. So no, I don't. I don't actually carry makeup with me.
So let's just say we've learned a lot of lessons from episode one.
Tell people that they're going to be videoed.
Yeah. So hopefully the podcast has gotten better since episode one and we don't lose too many listeners who just listen to episode one and think, nah, stuff it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but the third most downloaded episode was with Wade Needham, which was actually episode number two, where he talked about how health and safety and HR need to work together. Number seven with Heather Eichen, talking about the role of organizational psychologists in psych health and safety. And then actually Peter Kelly and Marianne Baton, the live panel that the three of us did on ISO 45003 just after its release was episode, the fifth most downloaded episode. So does that make sense? Thoughts on that, Alicia?
No big surprises there. Apart from episode one, because it was probably not as known, I would say, the podcast being the first episode. But yeah.
Yeah, I think it's because, you know, that's over the year, right? So people might, you know, come across the podcast in some way or another and then go, oh, let's listen to the first episode and then kind of listen to them sequentially. Uh-huh. So that's probably, I'd say, the reason for that. But you know what? I've actually brought on someone from the fifth most downloaded episode today to wish us happy birthday. All the way from the UK, it's one of our regulars on the podcast, Peter Kelly.
Hooray.
How are you? Good day.
Peter, what sort of ungodly hour is this?
It's 7 minutes to two in the morning. I'm only doing this for you, Jason, because I'm going to be in Australia in a couple of days and someone's going to owe me a beer. So, I think
that'll have to be Alicia because you won't be able to get into Perth. So
it's all right. Alicia, you charge it to Jason.
Yes, I will. I'll send him the bill.
Yeah. So it works out well for us, Peter, that you're an insomniac and you were awake about half an hour ago, just before I said, we're about to start recording. And you're like, oh, would you like me to come on? I'm like, yeah, that'd be great, Pete.
No, it's fine. I'll sleep in the morning. That's fine. So, but it's been a, well, God, what a year, eh? When you started this a year ago, look at where we are now. So, you know, you've got the British version, the Canadian version, the Asian version as well, based out of Singapore. So just goes to show that people are really, really looking for information in this area. And I think happy to work on that. For some of us, you know, Jason, Alicia and Joelle, you know, we've been plugging away at this for years and we're just starting to see, I think, a change in people's attitudes towards. And I think that's these podcasts are very much a part of, you know, educating people during lockdown about what they can do to improve people's workplaces. So that's me being serious for once. So there you go.
Pete, you can always turn it on when you need to.
I don't know. It's a good old civil service servant in me, isn't it? But
that's it. Public service.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I mean, we've had an incredibly complex year, and you know, I did a post on LinkedIn today, and I said we need to reset the way we view this whole area, because I think for so long we've focused on individual issues, and now actually this is a chance to reset on organization, which is job crafting, how you make the job better, and really stick to that. My concern is we'll default to looking after individuals and not really addressing the sources of work-related stress and depression and anxiety. When I, you know, before I came into this job, I was working in clinical work, and I'd have a clinic on a Wednesday afternoon, and 50% of the people I'd seen had mental health issues due to work. I was like, that doesn't make me, you know. So I'd be seeing them because they were suffering from depression and anxiety in the clinical setting, but the contributing factors were work-related stress or mental health. And that kind of led me into this area, which surely we should be preventing rather than curing. I don't know what you think, Alicia, because obviously, you know, you've been in clinical practice as well. But it seems a far more efficient and effective way we look after people.
Yeah.
At the organisation.
Exactly the same experience from my end. So my background is I'm trained as a clinical psychologist and moved into the occupational health space probably 8 years ago now, but that's what I was finding too, was, you know, people are coming in for depression, anxiety symptoms, stress, and, you know, when you explore the reasons why and they're coming from the workplace, there's only so much you can do, you know, as a private practice provider in the community. You can't actually influence anything at the workplace. You can only help the person from an individual perspective. And there still is a lot of, you know, presentation in clinical practice around work-related stress. So that was my motivation to shift more into this space too.
Yeah, and we know from the World Health Organization and a study by Kessler in May 2020, about 20% of people are experiencing depression and anxiety over and above the one-fifth of people that were already. So potentially we're looking at about 40% of the working population are experiencing depression or anxiety. We only last year recorded 17.9 million days lost to work-related stress, which represents 57% of the sickness absence. And that actually represents 51% of all absences in work. And that is in Australia, and that's in Canada and various other places. So someone who was on a conference call yesterday and said, I think the H is becoming a capital and the S is becoming a small. And I'm like, I really, listen, they're both the same size because they both influence each other. But, you know, if we said 20 years ago we'd have conversations now what we're having, we couldn't have done this. We couldn't have done this 10 years ago. We couldn't have had this conversation. And I think that's just because actually there's been an awakening of people to realize that actually, you know, the psychological health is just as important, I think. And, you know, so your podcast, Jason, when you started out, was really about that education piece. You know, you came in halfway through the pandemic, people were desperate for information, desperate to know, and actually it was done in a good way. Obviously you can improve, but there you go.
Yeah, no, it was definitely, driven by a number of factors, but we also knew that, I guess, there was going to be an appetite for this given the ISO 45003 standard that would be released last year, as well as, you know, movement around regulations and whatnot. You got a Zoom background on, Pete, so we can't see what you're holding up.
I'm just taking it off.
Is that the standard in front of you?
You can have that picture. I used that with my chief executive once, and she stopped me video. she thought it was hilarious. Let's do the no background. None. There she is.
Yeah.
The ISO 45003, the standard, in a lovely color of red.
And we have to thank you, Peter, as well as all the other committee members, the technical committee members, for hours of debate and discussion to get that done, because I hate doing things by committee, and I could only imagine what sort of hell that would have been trying to get consensus from, 70 to 80 representatives from different countries.
74 countries, yeah. So I didn't believe it was possible to define risk over 4 hours. The word risk.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, I think it was relevant for its time and really important. I can't do this picturing myself at the back. It's just cracking. I'll just change the virtual background. There you go. But yeah, I think it's important. It came at its time. Ideally, what we would have done when we launched the management standards in 2004 is what we did in 45003.
Yeah.
Would have put the back end of it. And that's the really important bit. And I think that's what 45003 does. It puts the back end onto the regulation. It says, what's it? How are we going to view this? You know, I mean, me and Jolie have come from the same sort of background, which is actually assessing the hazards, the level of hazard, and how, you know, what, where's the risk. When I go in to do an investigation as a health and safety inspector, I want to know what they've done to manage that hazard. I want them first to know there is a hazard. And one of the things the pandemic has done, I don't know about you, but it's really put out there mental health. Yeah. It's like you need to think about your mental health for your employees. Whether or not they do it, I guess that's another thing. When, you know, but it's certainly not in like, oh, I didn't know anything about it. Because you can't pick a paper up here in the UK without some reference to mental health or work, mental health and work.
Yeah, and I think that's actually one of the things that will help maybe advance the cause, even outside of places like Australia, Canada, and the UK, which are already probably more mature than many other places in the world. But we're definitely seeing that in throughout Asia and other places that were probably less mature when it came to workplace mental health. The pandemic has really shone a light on this, and people are wanting to deal with it. And then all this discussion around burnout has also then started to get people to think about, well, if the root cause of burnout is poorly managed work, well, then the way we deal with this is not to deal with the symptoms, it's to deal with the poorly managed work. So, yes, some really good discussions out there at the moment around the topic of burnout and dealing with it systemically rather than focusing purely on individuals and symptoms.
And also some rubbish strategies of let's give everybody a week off and that'll fix it.
Yes. Yeah, Joel was very vocal about some of these multinationals. Let's give them a week off. That was the way to deal with burnout.
Let's provide them with yoga and do some mindfulness and a bit of resilience. I've stopped talking about mindfulness and resilience. I talk about organizational mindfulness and resilience now. I think that's where we need to change the conversation piece here. You know, we need to create jobs that are designed around people, not people designed around jobs. And that I think the pandemic has done that. And acknowledging the fact that in the next 10 years, we are facing a crisis in terms of mental health. We have 16-year-olds that are coming into workplaces as apprentices now that have had 2 years off and a year in their most developmental years when they're not being in the context of work at school. So we're actually seeing mental health being born into the younger generation. And we're seeing older people going the great resignation, moving on, doing everything else. So this idea, you know, we'll get back to normal, we'll just suddenly get back in an office. You know, we may never go back to non-hybrid working. But with hybrid working, if we don't put the right resources in and the right connections and the right way to work, then potentially it has the potential impact to be just as uncomfortable for people as working in an office where it's not controlled.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think we started the year last year, Peter, with the podcast really talking about, you know, what we expected to see regarding an increased focus on systemic approaches to workplace mental health. you know, using more of a risk framework, continuous improvement, as was going to be in the ISO 45003 standard. We've definitely seen that. There's definitely an increased appetite to do that. And I believe people are starting to become more knowledgeable in this space. Hopefully the podcast has had a little bit to do with that. But we know that there's a lot of people doing great work in this area, yourself included, with Sheila, with the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast, as well as all of your other advocacy work that you do over there in the UK.
We're just a sub of your
yeah, you're just a spin-off, Pete.
Yeah. We're never now you've got to bring the whole cricket thing, haven't you? Like a spin-off, because as an Australian, it's really difficult over here not to feel gluttony when Australia rips apart the English cricket. But you know, for the purpose of this podcast, I'm standing up for the British.
Yeah, we won't mention the Ashes. But Pete, I am conscious of the time it is
at you do have to go to bed
at some point. Yeah.
I'm gonna head to bed, but hey, happy birthday, guys. Well done. You know, who'd have thought a year ago you'd be this far in and you've done the work. You're doing great work. And I'm really happy to be on this journey with you. And let's keep it going. Let's change the world of work, hey?
Sounds good to me, Pete.
Yeah. So let's not stick with the mantra that it's uncomfortable, it's unchangeable. We can change this world of work, and we have to, because the pandemic is a game changer and it's changed a lot of things. At least it only comes along once every century, so we've got 100 years to work out what we need to do next. So I will definitely be gone by then. But anyway, guys, as it's 6 minutes past 2 in the morning, I'm going to say goodnight. Been lovely to chat to you. And now you can say whatever you need to say about me. So, but I'll be listening. I'll be listening. And Alicia, I'll see you in a couple of weeks in Melbourne. Yeah. Mr. Miyake, I'm on it.
I've booked a dinner for us to chat more about.
Is it Chinese or Japanese that we're going?
It's a modern Asian fusion, but a Japanese focus.
That means it's expensive, Jason.
Oh, Melbourne.
It's going on the expenses.
It's a Melbourne culinary experience.
Yeah. So wanker experiences.
Okay.
Oh, I can't believe you said that word.
Jason's just jealous.
You can delete that word from this podcast.
We'll have to put an explicit tag on there now.
Is it an explicit word? Thanks, Pete.
Yeah. It could be an explicit word. In Australia, it's a descriptive word, Jason.
Yeah, okay.
I've got you back on that one. See you later, guys. Good night.
Bye.
Night, buddy. All right. Well, thanks to Pete for his well wishes and for joining us for a brief amount of time on this podcast episode. It was great to reflect on the year that was with him and, really great work that him and Sheila are doing through the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast. Today, though, what we thought we might do is start to think about 2022 and what does the future of psych health and safety look like in 2022. And Joelle, Alicia and myself have been having lots of conversations with some early movers in this space. I think we'd all agree that psych health and safety is pretty new to most companies. Most companies are only just starting to think about what they're going to do in this space. And I guess what we've really identified is that there's four critical issues that companies are trying to contend with when thinking about adopting psych health and safety. And this is after you've gotten executive buy-in and commitment to doing psych health and safety well. Just briefly, and we're going to go into detail on each of these, but we are talking about health and safety and HR training to build up their competence in not just understanding what a psych hazard is, but also how do we actually influence in this area and incorporate a proper approach that is operationalized and feeds into our other systems and processes. Line manager training. We know that hazards can be very different from team to team based on the leadership and the team dynamics. And so therefore it's very important for line managers to be involved in the risk assessment process. And because they're there, they can also be very agile and quick to identify and mitigate hazards as they arise. So we're going to talk a bit about that. Another thing that keeps coming up again and again, and that's why we're very passionate about Flourish DX, the tool that we work on, is that people are after a tool that will help them to effectively measure risk, monitor hazards over time as well. So we'll talk a little bit about that and some of the issues about past practice and what we think future practice should look like. And then finally, creating action plans. So lots of people are doing, or many more people are dipping their toe, I should say, in the water of doing a risk assessment and maybe using something like a HSE stress indicator tool or a people at work survey. But then there's the important next step of what are we going to do with this information? What actions are we going to create? How are we going to monitor and review the controls that we're putting in place to deal with our identified risks as well? So what we'd like to do today is to talk through those four issues, and each of us will weigh in a little bit on each of these. Hopefully we can give some advice and some direction about what you might think about in each of these four issues. So starting off with this idea of health and safety and HR training to support the organisation, it's obviously very important that it's not just one core group or one person within an organization that understands the risk management process. We need health and safety and HR to partner with the business, including line managers, to make sure that this is done well. So I know, Alicia, you've done a lot of work in this area of training. I know a lot around line manager training as well, but ideally you'd obviously want to train health and safety HR people first, given that they're the ones that are going to be asked to support the line managers as they try and adopt something that's completely new and foreign to them. So what are some of the things that you think we might need to think about, or companies might need to think about when training health and safety and HR people in this area?
So, yeah, you're definitely right. Because as we've heard a lot on the podcast as well, even from early on as episode 2 with Wade talking about HR and health and safety working together, there needs to be a common understanding about what risk management looks like in this space. The reason why the training needs to occur to get everyone on the same page between HR and health and safety is, from one perspective, a risk management approach is, like you said before, is about identifying what the risks are and then measuring them. But when we're talking about psychological health and safety, as opposed to, general health and safety. So general health and safety is, your overt risks in the workplace, slips, trips, falls, those types of things. When we're talking about psychological health and safety, the risks are, they're HR related, right? So when we're thinking about psychosocial hazards, those types of things we need to be aware of, and then think about, how do we intervene? How do we manage this space? If HR isn't really aware of what psychosocial hazards are, then they're probably doing, their own work in their own teams. And then there's a lot of silos occurring in terms of the approach. So it's really important to educate HR and health and safety to have a streamlined approach to integrate, so that there's a common understanding around psychosocial hazards are really about HR related practices and processes in the workplace, and to work together to be able to implement effective risk management approaches and figure out who owns the processes, who owns the action plans, who's going to support, like you said before, the line managers. Is it HR? Is it health and safety? So you can really allocate the resources within the two areas of HR and health and safety adequately to support this function.
Yeah, it's interesting, this whole idea of the different backgrounds that health and safety professionals versus HR professionals have, and the language that they're accustomed to using, and their point of intervention. I think health and safety professionals are largely more focused on dealing with risk systemically these days, whereas HR still are very much involved with things like EAP wellness kinds of approaches. So it's more individuals and symptoms, if you like. And in fact, this was really born to light a little while ago when I was having a conversation with a multinational, and it was a number of HR people on the call. They did have a health and safety person at the beginning, but unfortunately he had to leave partway through the call. But we were talking about this idea of risk assessment, and one of the HR people said to me, Yeah, I like all of this, but can we change the name? I just don't like the term risk. And I think, well, this is largely a health and safety podcast, right? And I think all of the people who listen to it from that background will go, well, duh, this is what we talk about. This is what health and safety is all about, understanding and managing risk. So, Joel, do you really think that there's a problem with the term risk, or is it something that HR just needs to embrace and maybe learn a bit more about?
I guess different disciplines use the word risk in different ways. And so, you know, coming from a background of health and safety, risk is just the likelihood of something happening and the consequences of that thing happening. So risk isn't inherently a bad thing. It's a neutral term. It's about understanding what your exposure is. And then, you know, if that exposure is past a threshold of acceptability, then taking steps to address that and reduce your exposure to a level that is acceptable. So, yeah, I think that, you know, the colloquial usage of the word risk is different to the technical use of the word risk. And that's probably where that attitude comes from HR would be thinking about risk in that more generalized language rather than in that that language of health and safety and risk management.
Yeah, I think it's definitely language that they shouldn't be shying away from, and they should learn to embrace if they understand
what we're talking about. Yeah, it's a matter of actually understanding, you know, what do we mean when we say risk when we're talking about it in a health and safety context. So it's like, you know, if you're having a conversation with somebody and they say, oh, I've got a theory that blah, 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 where if we were having a scientific-based conversation, somebody would say, my hypothesis is such and such, and the collection of evidence suggests this theory or informs this theory. So I think it's a similar thing where, you know, the use of theory in everyday conversation is very different to what theory actually means when we're taking a scientific lens to it. So it's that same, you know, there's a process of understanding the context in which you're using those words and what those words mean in those particular contexts.
Yeah. And I guess it's important. If you think about the board, the exec, they're going to be talking about risk, business risks.
Absolutely. They talk about all kinds of risks. Yep. Yeah. So safety, financial, reputation, you know, all of those things. So we can't just not use the word risk because it has some negative connotations. That's, you know, are you going to just stick your head in the sand and pretend that things don't exist?
Well, on that, there are some people who have, commented as well in the past year that, there is a fear of doing a psychosocial risk assessment because they're concerned about what risks might appear that they'd then have to do something about. So if we don't measure risk, does that mean it doesn't exist? Like,
so I guess what they're looking for there is plausible deniability, right?
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately for those people, plausible deniability is not a reasonable justification from a OHS law perspective. So, you know, the law in Australia requires that you identify your hazards, assess the risks associated with them, and then take appropriate measures to reduce those risks to a level that is as low as reasonably practicable. So the fact that you have gone out of your way to avoid looking for hazards isn't going to absolve you of your duties under the OHS legislation.
Yeah. So
that's blunt, but that's how it is.
Yeah. And I guess with the new regulations that we're expecting in Australia and Victoria in the coming months, then, you know, and all the codes of practice to support that, you know, there's going to be less places for people to hide.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the idea of the model regs is to help organizations to understand how to do this properly. You know, for larger organizations with more mature safety management systems where they've got well-established processes for hazard identification and risk management, it's probably easier to see how you can align psychological health and safety with those existing processes. But, you know, that's not the case for a lot of organizations. And, you know, I think the majority of, in Australia anyway, the majority of businesses are small or medium enterprises, so they do need that additional instruction in how to do this properly. And I think that that's where the regs are going to step in. And the codes of practice obviously have been published recognizing that there was that lack of information there. Typically you'd have your regs in place before your codes of practice, but codes of practice are a lot easier to get up and published than regulations are. So I think that's why it's happened in this particular order, just because there was recognised that this information was really needed by business, and we can't wait for regs to be drafted and go through that whole lengthy process of actually becoming official.
Yeah, yeah. So still as of today, Safe Work New South Wales is the only one to have finally published their code of practice. WA has theirs in draft. We haven't seen the drafts from the other states yet.
Well, the DEMAs have had their code of practice, and that's specifically for FIFO industries. So, yeah, the only industry agnostic one, yes, although Safe Work WA has published a draft.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah. They've got their draft out. Yep. But we know all the other states are working on their drafts, but they haven't published that yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hopefully we'll be able to get representatives from Queensland and so Work Health and Safety Queensland and WorkSafe Victoria to talk about their codes of practice once they've published them.
Yeah. Yep.
But so I guess the key things to think about with training, to summarise there, is health and safety people, they're probably all very familiar with risks and safety management systems and whatnot. Probably the thing that they're most concerned about is what is a psychosocial hazard, and understanding that you can manage psychosocial risks in the same way that you do physical risks using a risk management framework.
Yeah, I think that the other side of that is, what are your control measures, and your safety generalists aren't necessarily going to be the best people to come up with the control measures, and probably not going to be the right function to have ownership of those control measures necessarily. So I guess that's the other element of the training as well, is where does ownership for different processes sit? So, you know, if you think about the health and safety function, where they have ownership of the risk management process, or that process of identifying and assessing risk and ensuring that controls are developed, but then, you know, actually drawing in the right expertise to help inform the design of those control measures to make sure that they're appropriate, and then ownership of those control measures are going to sit within sort of different functions in an organization.
Yeah, so similarly how they might work with engineering or electricians or whoever, to manage the risks identified in those specific areas. They can draw in OD professionals, org psychs, HR people to help control the risks that have been identified. Okay. So with HR, then, they are less familiar with risk management principles and just introducing them to that. And maybe that will be a bit of a change for them, moving away from what they're more familiar with, which would be maybe identifying individuals who are distressed and getting them to support, like through EAP. And rather, what we're trying to do now is get them to think systemically.
Yeah, so I think David Proven made quite a good point, where he sort of talked about the key difference in the approaches between HR and health and safety, where, HR tends to focus on changing the person, health and safety focuses on changing the work. So from that perspective, it is a bit of a conceptual shift, I think, for your traditional HR professional with your HR training. If you've got people in HR with psych backgrounds, it's potentially easier to see those connections and see the systems of work kind of thing. And especially if you've got that OD background as well, you have more of an understanding of systems of work. So I think that it's about really drawing in the right people with the right skill sets and the right competencies to be able to deliver. And obviously, here we're talking about, where you do have large organizations and you've got that variety of skills and backgrounds and experience. And for SMEs, that's not necessarily possible or practicable.
Yeah. And I guess that reminds me of, I've had probably several of these conversations before when demonstrating, the risk assessment capabilities of Flourish DX, where a HR professional has said, so is this going to help us to identify individuals that are having an issue?
Mm.
And I'm like, well, it's actually not about identifying the individuals so much as seeing where you've got clusters of people who've got the same kind of shared experience in response to the design of work, which is then suggesting it's a work design issue rather than an individual issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it is a big conceptual shift, I think, from that, you know, from looking at it at the individual to looking at it from a systems perspective.
Yeah. So definitely training required for health for HR people in that regards and health and safety regards, as we've spoken about. The next element that we want to talk about is around line manager training. So line managers are really pivotal, we believe, in psych health and safety and distinct from, say, employee engagement kind of approaches where it's often done at a global level. We really believe that psych hazards can be very different from team to team. So line managers are probably best placed to help identify and manage the hazards at that level.
Unless the line manager is the hazard.
Unless the line manager is a hazard. And then hopefully a risk assessment done at a global level will identify that and other people can step in. But Alicia, you were involved in developing line manager training in your previous role at a university. You know, what were some of the key things that you were considering when designing that training?
Yeah, so I suppose you have to think about, you know, what your objectives are for the training. A lot of the line manager training that kind of exists at the moment or that organizations are doing is at the level of it's kind of like that early intervention approach, you know, how to have supportive conversations with your staff. And that's coming off of maybe being able to better recognize signs and symptoms of poor mental health in the workplace, you know, and then what to do about that. So that's one component for sure, is how to be a supportive leader or manager. But then the other side is around upskilling your line managers in understanding what these psychosocial hazards are. And you know, like you said before, Joelle, maybe the line manager is the hazard. But I find a lot of the time that's unbeknownst to the line manager. So it's inadvertently they're the hazard, but they're not necessarily aware of it, or whether that's not self-aware or they're not getting the feedback. So and not understanding, you know, how they're the hazard in the first place. So a lot of it is around, you know, if we think of what psychosocial hazards are, a lot of it will come from how work is managed, and that is really dictated by line managers, isn't it? So if you're not managing work well, for example, you're not ensuring that your team members are clear on their role, if you're not providing enough support, if you're not fostering kind of team cohesion, all of these types of things are posing risks to staff mental health. So it's really, really important when thinking about line manager training. It's not just, you know, how to support staff. It's actually understanding and increasing that capability of what these psychological hazards are in the workplace and how they can be addressed so that they're not posing risks.
Yeah.
I think it was probably a little bit of a glib comment there that I made about the line managers being the hazard, but just to, I guess, reiterate a point that we've made a few times is that, you know, behavior is still an outcome of somebody's experience within an organizational system. So if a line manager's behavior is actually problematic for their team, the likelihood is that that's, you know, a reflection of the pressures that are being placed upon them from other areas of the organization. And, you know, do they have good role clarity? Are they overworked? You know, what is the support that they're getting from line management, you know, their line management, and is there clarity around what it is that their team is supposed to be delivering and all of those types of things. So, you know, all of those issues that can exist for frontline employees can also exist for line managers. And if we've got a situation where there is poor line management, the likelihood is that it's a consequence of other psychosocial hazards impacting on that particular line manager rather than it being just a, you know, a personality problem or something like that.
Yeah, which is really interesting and poignant. We are actually having a discussion with a client at the moment who would like to roll out the risk assessment amongst all managers first before rolling it out with employees. And that would help them to identify, I guess, some of those systemic issues that are causing line managers distress before then thinking about the employees So the root cause for employees might be line manager behavior, whether that's poor support or lack of role clarity or workload management. But that, like you say, could the root cause could be something else entirely that is affecting the line manager.
Mm.
Yeah. So I guess it's important to think about that. From both perspectives, and line managers need training to understand these sort of concepts. The other thing that we keep hearing from clients is that it's all well and good to teach people about psych health and safety, or what is a psych hazard and how to apply a risk management approach to understanding and addressing these. But what are they practically going to do with that information when they go back? Is it just going to be a conceptual thing that they go back with, or are we giving them tools to actually use to help understand and respond to risks? And so really our recommendation would be, if you're going to go to the effort of spending time training your line managers and all the time and resources required to do that, well, you might as well teach them how to use a tool, whether that's Flourish DX or another tool that you're using. It's really important to give them the tools when they go back to work that they've got something practical to apply, rather than just going back to work with a bunch of theories and concepts.
Well, yeah, and we know, basic education theory, and especially for adult education, is if you don't use it, you lose it. So any good training will also include, here's how you're going to go back and use this, and potentially here's some homework and you're going to come back in a month and this is what you're going to come back with and show us how you've actually implemented this in your team and how it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, also where potentially we can see health and safety and HR coming in actually providing that sort of mentoring for line managers and actually going through that process, supporting them and having those types of conversations and, thinking about control measures and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's the old 70-20-10 rule, right? So 10% of your learning might be through formal education. 70% of it is probably going to be on the job.
Mm.
What are you doing practically? Anything to add to that, Alicia?
Yeah, just reflecting on what you were saying, in terms of training, it isn't just, this one-off educational training, and thinking about your organization and how big it is and what your HR and health and safety structure looks like. It's actually beneficial to have, if you've got a leadership, an OD team or leadership capability team, and thinking about, are they going to own these types of programs where, whether it's monthly check-ins or refreshers or whatever it is, to reflect on how they're implementing the skills and how they're continuously supported, so that these, I call it a program, but it's really, it's business as usual. How is that going to be supported by HR, health and safety? Thinking about it long term and embedding it, and how is it sustainable?
Yeah, and that's again why we advise about training HR and health and safety to partner with line managers before bothering training line managers, because they're going to need that ongoing support. It's not just a one-off education program. Okay, so that brings us and probably a nice segue into the next topic, which is around having that tool to assess and monitor risk. One of the key issues, I guess, and I think we've spoken about it previously on the podcast, is the lack of information to help really identify hazards and risks, and the fact that many organizations at the moment are being either forced to use, say, employee engagement survey data, or maybe just adding a few questions to their employee engagement survey, doing it on that once a year cadence, and hopefully that gives enough information to understand risk. One of the things that has been really useful when talking to customers who feel like they're being, cornholed into doing that, is to ask then the people who are doing these surveys or facilitating them from the organization, well, are you going to give me information around the severity, frequency, and duration of hazard exposure, so I can understand risk? And you can imagine most often when you've got like maybe one question dealing with workload, you're not going to get that level of information from a typical employee engagement survey.
Or any kind of perception survey. So I think that's probably the other point to raise there, is that, there are a number of tools in market at the moment calling themselves risk assessment tools, psychosocial risk assessment tools. And I would argue that they're not actually risk assessment tools. They are providing you, they're perception surveys, first of all. So they're providing you with people's perceptions of the design of work. But it doesn't give you any indication of the risk present or absent as a consequence of that particular design of work. So, for example, you might get a result that says workload is high compared to an industry benchmark, but that doesn't tell you anything about the level of risk that people are exposed to as a consequence of that relatively high workload. And we know that, you know, some people do thrive in high workload, and it's more about, you know, what's the kind of work that I'm being asked to do? Is it work that I enjoy? Is it work that I can really get involved in and sort of get into that state of flow while I'm in it? Is it achievable? You know, do I get a sense of self-efficacy out of it? All of that kind of thing. If you've got that with a high workload and you've got a supportive leadership and you've got a good level of autonomy in, you know, how you're going to do your work and how you're structuring it and all of that kind of thing, then high workload isn't necessarily a hazard. And it's not actually creating a risk. So if we've got a perception survey that's just telling us where our work factors sit against a benchmark, that's not a risk assessment. That's just a work factors assessment. And so we actually need to understand, if we think about it again from a health and safety lens, and if we think about it from an occupational hygiene perspective, if we want to understand risk associated with hazard, we need to understand exposure. So what is the well-being impact that this hazard is having on the workplace? How long does it last when it happens? And how often are people exposed? And it's only when you're getting those three pieces of data about a hazard that you're starting to understand what is the likelihood that people are actually going to be injured as a result of exposure to this hazard.
Yeah, well articulated. And it's a real paradigm shift, I think, from what people are expected. I mean, one of the first tools in the space was the HSE stress indicator tool, and it very much uses that employee perception kind of approach. But, you know, we're in agreeance here that, you know, that will tell you about the design of work. It won't tell you about the likelihood that someone's going to have a psychological injury based on that hazard exposure. Mm. It's much the same way that we might assess the risk of hearing damage if someone was to be exposed to noise at work. To understand the risk, we need to understand how loud the noise is, what is the severity of the noise that people are exposed to whilst in the workplace, but also, you know, how often does it occur and how long does it last for? And with those three bits of information, then we actually can understand a level of risk of hearing loss. But if you just ask people, are you in a noisy environment, yes or no, or strongly agree to strongly disagree, that's not going to give you enough information to determine the likelihood of an injury occurring.
Mm.
Anything to add to that, Alicia?
No, I think Joelle summed it up pretty well there. There's a lot of tools now in the market that are employee perception based around work factors. And I think it's, you know, as things shift, it's really thinking about, you know, what is a risk assessment, like you're saying, what is the level of risk that these hazards are posing? And you can't really know that unless you ask about, you know, what impact is this having on your well-being and how long for and, you know, when does it occur? So, moving forward, for organisations and employees to understand what a psychosocial risk assessment actually is.
Yeah, and I'm really happy that we're innovating in this space and bringing out assessments that do actually assess severity, frequency and duration of hazard exposure, and it'll be really exciting in the coming months as we start to build up our predictive algorithms that will actually be linked to outcomes like burnout and psychological distress that will actually give you a predictive risk rating versus just a comparison to a benchmark, which, as Joelle said, doesn't really tell you a lot, just as comparatively how you're going against, you know, maybe an industry that isn't managing that risk particularly well anyway.
Mm. Yeah, so if you're doing slightly better than the industry, but the industry's doing terrible, that's still, you know, you're not doing great.
Yeah, that's right. And you could still be having psychological injury. So again, you're not understanding the risk. Another thing, I guess, when talking about measurement of psychosocial risk or looking at hazards is the cadence. And often, again, if you're being cornholed into using the employee engagement survey, but the employee engagement survey is only conducted once a year, well, a lot can happen in a year and a lot of new hazards can arise. The other issue is if you've implemented some controls and then you need to wait a year to the next employee engagement survey to determine whether your controls are being effective. Again, a lot can happen in the space of a year and a lot of psychological injury could still occur by not being on top of the hazards.
Yeah, so it is about having that regular opportunity to touch base and see, you know, what's going on for employees, because new hazards can pop up all the time as well. You know, situations change, change initiatives, you know, control measures that you've implemented, they may actually create new psychosocial hazards that you hadn't anticipated. And yeah, as Jason said, leaving it for a year before you check in again, you know, you may well have a number of psychological injuries already in progress at that stage. Whereas if you are doing that regular monitoring, you've got the opportunity then to intervene early. So I have used the analogy before. It's a little bit like corrosion when we talk about psych hazards, that, you know, we know that corrosion is always there in potential. We can put things in place that we know will, you know, reduce the speed and the spread and all of that kind of thing. But we still need to do regular monitoring so that we know when corrosion starts to occur, when it is getting to a point where we need to address it. And then once we've actually identified it, then we can put measures in place to address it properly. And it goes the same for psych hazards.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I love that analogy. And in that way, it could actually be a one of the controls, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're looking at it from a risk register perspective, you know, you might have, I guess, your global psych hazards like bullying, harassment, you know, those types of things. And then you might have another line item that says, you know, general psychosocial hazards. And your control measure is actually monitoring, and this is how we're going to do the monitoring, this is how frequently we're going to do it, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of where I think that can fit in your high-level risk register.
Yeah, and we're not suggesting that companies, you know, do a full, you know, 10 to 30-minute psych risk assessment to monitor hazards. You know, we have tools like our wellbeing check-in. If you haven't already on our 45,003 training academy, we do have a training course on how to conduct a psychosocial risk assessment. And we talk about how you can use like a 30-second wellbeing check-in to identify how people are traveling in terms of their wellbeing, but then also what are the contributing factors, either from an individual or a workplace perspective. And that 30-second assessment is something that can be shared with line managers. So again, that line managers can very quickly identify changes to the hazard profile within their teams and be able to respond in an agile manner, rather than, again, waiting for a big, long, convoluted risk assessment process to happen at a global level and then actions happening over a period of months after that. We're talking about within the same 20-minute period, you could have all staff in a team complete a wellbeing check-in, review the results together and actually even agree on what are you going to do to address some of these things.
Yeah, because a lot of them will be at a team level actions that can be implemented at a team level, and it doesn't actually need to go through a whole org change process, but it's just something that, you know, as a group, we're going to do this and we think that will impact this hazard, and then, you know, you can check back in a month and see whether it's been effective or not.
Yeah. And look, I don't know if it's because people perceive psych risk assessment to be such a convoluted and lengthy process. I mean, if you look at tools like People at Work, for example, you're talking about a 30-minute plus assessment there. Looks very similar to the employee engagement survey as well, which then leads to a big objection internally, usually, like, why are we just collecting the same data that we're collecting from our employee engagement survey? So it typically has a negative connotation to it. And in that way, some people are like, well, we don't really want to go through that process. We know what our main psych hazards are. We've done some desktop research, or from our industry, we understand these are our key things. So these are going to be our controls. But then I ask people on the back of that, then, well, how are you going to monitor whether your controls are being effective? Are you just going to have a focus group and go on gut feel from a, you know, a representative sample of the population? Are we doing better in this area or are we not? In a small company, you definitely get by just by having those regular check-ins with the group and seeing how things are going. But in a larger company, you know, it's probably better to quantify that risk using more of a survey tool, so that then it's not just about understanding the risk at that point in time, but then it's when you're monitoring your hazards, you can actually determine whether you are having the desired impact when you've implemented a control. Mm. Yeah. Anything to add to that, Alicia?
It's I think more around just being mindful of monitoring these hazards at the team level and then at the organizational level. And there's different tools and ways to do that, and it's important to do both, especially as an organization is you know, bigger or more matrix, it's really important to measure at these different levels.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like with the work that we do is, you know, how you can have that global view, but then you can compare across groups and even drill down into subgroups and identify, well, you know, workload is an issue globally, but are there particular divisions or, you know, parts in this matrix organization that are having more of an issue with that than others? Also, in particular, with high potential hazard exposure like bullying, harassment, sexual harassment, being able to isolate, you know, is that occurring in a particular group? Because that probably would require a different level of care and intervention when further exploring that hazard exposure and what you're going to do about it. And again, as we talked about, if the line manager is a hazard, being able to identify, you know, what are the teams where that might be an issue. And then again, it would be HR and health and safety being involved and not just the line manager themselves, you know, deciding what am I going to do about, you know, maybe my poor behavior or my lack of supervisory support. The next thing, I guess, and the last thing we want to talk about in this episode is about the action planning. So we are, as I mentioned at the top, that, you know, there are more companies that are starting to dip their toe in the water and starting to perform their first psychosocial risk assessments. But then action planning is something that is maybe not as enough time spent on or done only at a global level without thinking about maybe team-specific action plans. Is that something that you've seen, Alicia, before, working in a large matrix organization?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when you're working in larger organizations, there's a lot of silos occurring, different areas or departments are kind of doing their own thing. So it's important to, you know, think about a bigger scale organization-wide controls or solutions or interventions, but then it's also important to think about, you know, at the more local level, whether it's department level or site level or smaller team level, you know, what do we need to do to address maybe some of the risks that are coming at different time points. So that's where it's critical to think about, you know, it's one thing measuring risk and monitoring these hazards, but then it's like, what do we do about those? And when we're talking about organization-wide initiatives, where they're required, you know, HR are important in that regard because usually they have their own individual teams that will be focusing on a lot of their strategic initiatives that will roll out. So there's that level, the organizational level action plans, you know, and who's contributing to those. And then there's the more local level, team level, department level, which is, you know, should be line manager or department manager led, with support from health and safety, HR, whoever it is that's partnering with that business.
Yeah, and I definitely see, you know, there are some common controls that easily could be rolled at a global level. So, you know, education, for example, would be a global control. Like Joelle was mentioning before, monitoring can be considered a control on your risk register for psych hazards. So having a monitoring process using a tool like Flourish or whatever else could also be part of your control measures at a global level.
Yeah, and I think, again, to go back to talking about, you know, perception survey data, employee engagement data, a lot of the time that does lend itself very easily to organizational level controls, but they tend to be things like policy or training level controls. And we know that those are less effective. So that reinforces why we really need to look at it at a team level and have those interventions in place to address your team specific risk profile.
Yeah. So it's definitely in our development pipeline to have action planning tools available through Flourish DX that can be hold the hands, I guess, of line managers as they create those, but then have visibility upwards to your main administrators of the platform so they can see, you know, what percentage of line managers have completed a action plan on the back of a risk assessment? You know, what is the content of those? How are they going towards the achievement of the objectives of their action plan? And then that could actually be a much more positive, constructive conversation regarding the management of psychosocial risks rather than just asking people, you know, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I guess then also if you do have a regulator come in and want to have a look at how you're managing your psychosocial risk, you've got all of that there. You can show that you've got those actions in place. You know, you've done your risk assessment, you're doing your monitoring, you're delivering your actions. Hopefully you can do, you know, a post-intervention evaluation and show that you have actually reduced risk through your interventions, all of that sort of thing. So it does actually provide that good source of evidence to put to a regulator if they do want to come and have a look at your systems of work.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong, Joelle, but I guess there's three kind of things that are imposed on employers from regulators when it comes to psychosocial risk management. One is that you've completed a risk assessment. Second of all, you've done that in consultation with employees. And third, you've put in action plans to address the identified hazards, again, in consultation with employees.
Yeah, and also that you have a system of work that will support that process ongoing.
Yeah. So it hasn't just been a one-off activity.
That's right. Yeah. So it's embedded in your safety management system. It's part of your, you know, whatever your 12-monthly cycle or however frequently you're going to do it, but that you can demonstrate that you have actually established a system of work that's going to maintain this process over time.
Yeah. So if you look at things like ISO 45003, which we spoke about with Peter at the top of this episode, there's a number of other things that it suggests that you should consider, and that's really best practice. But from a legal perspective, you know, those are the key considerations that you'd have to have evidence for if a regulator was to come knocking at the door.
Yeah, from the WHS Act perspective, and then from the workers' compensation side of things, there's different legislation there that requires things like rehabilitation and return to work and all of that kind of thing. And that's a different set of legislation, but it still, I think, is relevant to this conversation because it is about, you know, making sure that things like your injury investigation processes are fit for purpose when you're talking about psychological injury. They're not necessarily going to be the same processes that you should follow for, you know, a physical injury investigation. They should be trauma informed and all of that sort of thing. So you're probably looking at having a specialist investigator to actually do that. And where you do have people who are on mental health leave, whether that's through workers' compensation or just through, you know, leave without pay or whatever other provisions you have in your organisation for that type of extended leave, that you do need to activate your return to work processes. And again, they need to be informed appropriately, and take into account reasonable accommodations for mental injury rehabilitation.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I've heard from a number of health and safety professionals that this is often the first time that they hear about a psychosocial hazard at the injury management stage, when someone said, oh, someone's been off work for a while, we need to get back to work. So involving health and safety much earlier will be great. And, we have definitely heard that, you know, with Omicron in particular, there has been a real focus of OHS on, you know, COVID relief or COVID response. And so they maybe not have been able to sink their teeth as much as they would have liked into psychosocial risk management at this point. But we definitely see 2022 as hopefully we get on top of this and WA finally gets exposure to Omicron and find out what this pandemic's all about.
I'd rather not.
Yeah, well, mate, look, we have to have it sometime, right?
Well, we've got it now, so.
Yeah, 10 cases. Oof.
Got more than 10.
Oh, 10 cases yesterday.
Yeah. So, that was Australia Day testing though, so you know that's numbers are going to be down.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, hopefully,
digress.
Yeah, health and safety, we obviously are going to play a really big role in the world of psych health and safety, psychosocial risk management. And it would be great to be able to get their attention once, you know, obviously it's obviously a needed focus on COVID. Hopefully they can get some more resources and time to focus on psychosocial risk management in 2022.
Yeah. So I think, again, to go back to one of the points that David Proven made about, you know, the composition of your safety team, yes, your safety generalists probably have been diverted and focusing on COVID response, and maybe, you know, your occupational hygienists, occupational nurses, that type of thing. But, you know, have your mechanical engineers been doing that? Have your process engineers been focused on COVID? I would imagine not. where they sit within your safety team or where there's overlap. So, you know, it is important to have that the right makeup in your safety team and actually have that subject matter expertise for psych health and safety sitting within your safety team in the same way that you would have it for reliability engineering or process safety or, you know, electrical engineering safety, whatever it might be.
Yeah. And as Peter mentioned at the top, from their data over there in the UK, 50% of all injury or illness absence from work was due to work-related stress, depression or anxiety. Mm. You'd imagine that most health and safety teams should be bolstering themselves if they haven't already with a psychologist to assist with that subject matter.
Yeah. Thinking again, you know, you can have a psychologist, but you need to make sure that you're hiring people who have that understanding of systems as well. So, you know, you could bring in a clin psych who's very focused on, you know, rehabilitation and treatment, and not really spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, the systems that are contributing to that. And, you know, recognizing Alicia in her clinical work saw the connection very clearly and went, yep, that's where I want to work. So, you know, certainly not saying that clin psychs can't do that work. I think it's a matter of making sure that, you know, when you're doing your recruitment processes, you're really clear that what you're wanting here is a person who can actually look at the work factors that are contributing to poor mental health and that the focus is on the work factors. It's not on treatment and recovery.
Yeah. And look, that might just require some upskilling for a psychologist who's absolutely got that general experience. And I think the
willingness as well to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, it has been raised a number of times, you know, there's been a number of people who on the back of listening to our podcast have gone out and enrolled in a master's degree in occupational psychology. We're not suggesting that everyone needs to go and do that. No. It's a very big commitment. But the only course that we've seen, accredited course in this space, is from Canada.
Yeah.
And you can reach out to us. We'll put it in the show notes, a link to that course, if you're interested. We will be working with David Proven at some point during 2022 as well to create a short course on psych health and safety that will be more aimed at health and safety practitioners who've got some, you know, basic understanding of health and safety and risk management.
So
creating action plans, though, is a piece that is often missing and often done at a global level. But as we've all been talking about, we really need to get down to that line manager level. And if we go through that process, right, of training up, first of all, health and safety and HR practitioners in this area, then our line managers providing them training and the relevant tools, then by the time you come to action planning, then, you know, everyone is kind of ready to get to that point in time and will have the resources and knowledge required to do that competently. So look, I am conscious of time, guys. We have been going for a little while. Thanks to Peter. he's always talkative, even if it is 2 o'clock in the morning. You can always count on that. I just want to finish up with maybe some of your hopes for workplace mental health. We ask all of our guests on the show, you know, what are your hopes for the future of workplace mental health? But maybe starting with you, Alicia, for 2022, what are your hopes? What can we achieve this year?
I think it's really just summarizing again the focus points that we've talked about in the podcast. So really around, you know, first and foremost is taking a risk management approach, a psychosocial risk management approach to workplace mental health. And that's that has a preventative focus. Like we've said, there's some pushback on using the word risk, but it's really just normalizing that word. It's got a negative connotation to it, but it's not a bad thing. You know, I hear a lot of working with clients, you know, when you talk about the purpose of a psychosocial risk assessment, what it will do for the organization, I get asked, can we just call it a well-being assessment? Well, well-being is a positive word, isn't it? It's got a positive connotation. So just not fearing risk assessment as a term, to normalize what that means, that it's a requirement, and just broadening that understanding of what it is within health and safety as a function and HR as well, and the need to work together to really undertake it most effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I've definitely been on some of those calls with you, Alicia, where, you know, a client is asking, oh, can we call it something else besides a risk assessment? So yes, I think that a lot of that comes down to education. Like, we've had to destigmatize the term mental health. I think we have to, at least for the HR profession and maybe the broader, you know, employee population who isn't from a risk background, that risk is actually a neutral term, as Joelle said.
Yeah, I think, again, if you're, you know, if we're talking about employees who are used to working in a environment of physical hazard, then talking about a risk assessment, they understand what that is mm-hmm. because they do it all the time. But if we're talking about a, you know, predominantly white collar workforce, then yeah, maybe those terms are a bit foreign and unusual to them.
Yeah, but yeah, hopefully we can start to embrace that term rather than shy away from it. Mm-hmm. And what about you, Joelle? What are your hopes for 2022 besides a birthday present?
My hopes for 2022 are that organizations stop using language like when things get back to normal. You know, this has been 2 years now that this pandemic has been impacting on the world of work and just the world outside of work as well. When things of this magnitude happen, a new normal is established, but it's not like the old normal. So things aren't going to go back to the way that they were pre-pandemic. That old book, Who Moved My Cheese, comes to mind. You know, so I think that for me, I would really like organizations to be thinking about what has worked for us during this pandemic that we can actually bring forward in establishing our new normal. You know, once the world stabilizes, what do we actually want that to look like? Employers who have been, I think, for a long time getting away with, you know, very poor work practices for their employees are currently dealing with the consequences of that. They need to get over it, adjust, and look at, you know, we're having a change in the paradigm of work, and it's no longer about, you know, people are lucky to work for us. It's that we are lucky to have people who want to work for us, and what can we do to make people want to work for us? So having that shift in thinking, I think, is going to be fundamental to any business being successful moving forward in 2022.
Yeah, the Great Reset, I guess, is what we're calling it now, right?
So, yeah.
Understanding there is a new normal, and, you know, employees are maybe learning that they can expect different things from their employers.
Not only learning, but demanding.
Yes, that's right. Well, great to celebrate.
Hang on. What are your hopes for 2022?
That the two of you are very, very busy with client work. We're definitely seeing already that there is a lot more interest in this space, and people, as I think I've mentioned already on this episode, companies are starting to understand they need to deal with things systemically. And as Alicia said, it's actually a lot more cost effective and impactful to deal with things at a systemic level rather than playing whack-a-mole at an individual level once individual issues arise. So I just hope to see more of that, and that our team grows to deal with all the demand with companies that are wanting to, you know, really impact on this, and you know, have subject matter experts guide them in this space. They're not all expected to be subject matter experts, and that's hopefully something that we can add value to, both through the podcast and then through consulting with companies. So hopefully the two of you are very busy and have many more colleagues throughout the course of 2022. That is my hope, not selfishly. listeners, that brings us to the end of our very special birthday episode. So thank you for joining us on this episode, and for our regular listeners, thank you for joining us throughout our first 80 episodes. You will be able to find some clips of this episode on the Flourish GX LinkedIn channel, and we'll produce the whole video on Flourish GX YouTube page as we normally do. Remember, all three of us are very active on LinkedIn. So if you want to continue the conversation, or if you have any questions, or if you'd like some support in any way, or suggestions for podcast episodes, reach out to myself, Alicia, or Joelle through LinkedIn as well. But that brings us to the end of this episode. We'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.